Enter, if you dare.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of New York.
Hi, this is Mike.
Hi, how's it going, sir?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
Good, good. We've had about a half hour of chatting before we're recording, you, me, and the next guest, and it's actually been a good talk, not necessarily horror either. But we do have the other guest, and that is a Connecticut American.
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how's it going?
It is going great, and I do want to say one thing before I forget. Phil, I really loved the poster costumes here post on Dark Discussions Facebook page yesterday on Halloween, and I really loved seeing everybody else's costumes. So next year, I want you to do it again, and I'm putting the call out to all the listeners. If you have costumes, post them, because I will definitely enjoy that. So post away.
It's all about Chrissy.
Yeah, it really is all about Chrissy. That was great yesterday, and I was sorry we didn't get more, because I was loving that. It was so awesome. People did such a great job. We have a bunch of creative listeners out there. It was really cool.
Yep. That's a Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group. So folks can go there and see. There's like 48 posts under that post and or follow-up posts under that post. And most of them are people who took pictures of themselves in costumes. So that's pretty cool. I did not dress up, but I did post my two daughters.
They were super cute. You're raising them right, Phil. No worries.
Trying the best. Let's see. So, Chrissy, I hear it's pretty nice weather out there where you're living.
It is. It's about 71 degrees right now. So I'm out on my back porch. I came home at about 5:30. I got home from work, and I've just been hanging out on the porch ever since. I figure, you know, here in New England, we gotta enjoy those warm days when we get them. So I am broadcasting from outside right now. We'll see how long that lasts because the temperature will drop. And then I'll just carry my computer inside. But this has been kind of cool, kind of nice. Feels like summer.
Excellent. So here we are, Dark Discussions Podcast. As I stated, a place where we discuss horror films. But we also discuss fantasy, sci-fi, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, midnight movies, and so forth. We basically try to talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence, usually neglected or poo-pooed by many folks. But as we see, horror and Marvel and all this other stuff is all becoming mainstream, and so we're trying to critique it more than just watch it. But a couple of things before we begin. Mike, you actually do another podcast, a couple of podcasts.
Well, you and the now banished from the podcast, Eric Webster, and, you know, we'll do the Game of Thrones podcast called You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, and Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, a Westworld podcast. And then we also have done the American Gods podcast, Searching for American Gods.
But anyway, let's see, Chrissy.
You can learn more about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com. I write short dark fiction, and I have my fingers in a lot of pies, so you can check that out over there. And if you can't remember that, just Google Christy Peterson Schoonover, and something will come up, because fortunately or unfortunately, there is still only one of me, so it shouldn't be too hard to find me.
Yep, you can actually go to darkdiscussions.com, and on the right, there's a link directly to both Mike's blog and Chrissy's website, and you can follow both at their websites as well. Also, on darkdiscussions.com are links to pages for every podcast that we've recorded, but you also can find us on Stitcher, iTunes, and Google Play, and at the bottom of every page are links to those places. Also, we have a Facebook group called Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, Twitter, Dark Discussion 1. We do have an email, darkdiscussions@aol.com. And what else? Oh, a Patreon. There's a big button at the top of darkdiscussions.com, but you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions where you can donate to the podcast. For every $5 that you donate, there's a chance that you can choose a topic for us to choose. So, for example, if you donate $15 for the month of October, you would have a chance to choose three films for us to do. So you could choose Count Dracula's Great Love, Malevolence, or The Adored, or you could choose The Adored three times. And what occurs is at the end of every quarter, we pull out a figurative hat a topic from all of our Patreon choices that you folks have given us. So last two that we've had has been Straw Dogs, the original 1970s film, and then a Deathgasm. And Deathgasm has actually already been recorded. Let's see. I guess we can probably begin with some news and stuff. Anything that...
I did want to mention, since Chrissy brought up the Halloween costumes. First of all, Chrissy, were you wearing something yesterday? Because I thought I saw a picture of you on that thread.
Yes, I was. I went as Little Red Riding Hood. It was a costume that Nathan, my husband, for those of you who are new, bought me because he goes the day after Halloween. He usually goes to like Savers or, you know, a Halloween store and gets me like, you know, costumes that are on sale. It did not come with a cape, so I did that and just put a red sweater over it. But yes, I was in costume too, and I shared it there. But that's why I also love seeing other people in costume, because it makes me feel like I'm part of a very special club. You know?
Yeah,
and yes, I went to work in it.
Okay, so. Cool. Well, some people put a lot of thought and effort and work into their costumes, and yeah. You know, and other people just kind of throw something on at the last minute, which was what I was yesterday. Although I'd already had it in mind, I had bought a silver shamrock baseball tee from Fright Rags about 6 months ago. And so when we were at Scares the Care weekend, I purchased the from, I think it's Trick or Treat Studios, the silver shamrock pumpkin mask. And I was expecting nobody to get that, except maybe one of my students. I actually had three kids who recognized what I was, that it was from Halloween 3. So the future the future is not as doomed as we have been foretelling.
Well, yeah, and that's really cool. And I just have to say too that I love any costume, and especially when, I mean, we don't get trick-or-treaters here at my house because we are so far off the beaten path. So for me, Halloween, the last 18 years I've been living here, has been kind of make my own magic. You know, I go to work, I dress up, and I go around to every other tenant in our building and pass out candy. And it's so special to see other adults dressing up, like even more so than kids, because it's all about getting in touch with your inner child and having fun. And I think those of us who are listeners to this podcast, which I was before I was a co-host, you know, to me, I really connected with that when I listened to this podcast. It's all about just being in that really awesome place of fantasy. So whether your costume is store-bought or whether it's homemade, and I grew up in the 70s where my mom made every costume homemade, and my mom was brilliant. She was a seamstress, and she really did beautiful work. But as a kid in the 70s, I would always kind of look at those plastic costumes with the masks and go, that's really cool, too. Like, I wish things could just be easy, and I didn't have to have 5,000 fittings, because my mom would start making costumes in, like, May, you know, and then she'd fit you all summer, like you were going to a wedding. You know, well, we got to check you and make sure you didn't gain 5 pounds, you know, that kind of stuff. So that's what I love about Halloween, is that I think it is a carte blanche to go out and be whoever you want to be, even if you're an adult, and do it. And there were some really sweet costumes yesterday on that post. Sweet.
Yeah, I was one of those kids from the 70s who wore one of those plastic costumes many years.
And I'm jealous of you. Yeah,
Oh, those were such shitty costumes.
Yeah, but they were
so terrible.
But they were terrible, but they were awesome at the same time because they said, hey, my parents are cool. They wanted me to go out and have the latest thing. You know, and my mom put so much effort into our costumes.
I
would always get made fun of. I would always get picked on because I had a homemade costume and everybody else had a store bought. So it's just interesting.
But there were these cheap.
How it shifted.
Yeah, for those who are younger, these were cheap vinyl like onesies you would put on.
Do they still make them, Mike?
No, not like that. Now they're
much. No,
they're much higher quality. And they would, like, if you wanted a Godzilla costume, you know, it'd probably be recycled the top half of an alligator mask or something that was just held together by a cheap rubber band. And it would always pull my hair and put on. And then the cheap vinyl suit you put on didn't look like it was a picture of Godzilla. You know, it wasn't actually made to look like Godzilla. So I can't remember the name of the guy. It was Ben something, I think. Ben Cooper, the Ben Cooper stuff. So go look online for Ben Cooper Halloween costumes if you want to get an idea of what Chrissy and I are being nostalgic about. Because, you know, it's sort of like you also had like Bastille, the Halloween decorations of like the haunted house and the ghosts and the black cats that everybody had the same cardboard, cheap ass stuff that you'd buy at every supermarket and. Because it wasn't this massive industry that it is now, which, by the way, as much as I'm not thrilled with the commercialization of Christmas, I'm all in for the commercialization of Halloween because the Halloween decorations are so much cooler now.
Well, we didn't have much back then. How about you, Phil? How do you feel about all this?
I was similar to Mike, where my parents. Or I should say my mother mostly, spent $5 for the plastic outfit with the half face mask. Like you get the front but no back, and it's with a rubber band that goes around the mask to hold it on your face. So I had a lot of those. But they were kind of cool, even though they were cheap, just for the fact that they were like characters that you wanted. So if you wanted to be Spider-Man, you could be Spider-Man or whatever. But my mother also... had me go as various other things. Like there was a time I went as a werewolf or the Wolfman, Lon Chaney Jr., my favorite movie, one of my favorite movies as a kid. So my mom, basically what we did was I had a poodle at the time, so we saved the poodle's hair, and we saved my hair.
Oh, God.
And then we just glued it onto my skin.
God, that's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, God. The one for me was in a similar vein was I'm probably guessing when I was 7, it must have, or 8, because it had to have been right when after Star Wars had come out. As I went as Chewbacca, and my mother had cut up. It's one of the few times it was not at in elementary school where it was not one of the Ben Cooper costumes. Where it was, she cut up like these old brown bath towels.
Oh, yeah.
And made a Chewbacca costume, and I ended up getting attacked by somebody's little dog when I went to get candy. It was like dangling from, and I was like only 7 years old, so it had to be a tiny dog because it was that holding up your leg and trying to shake it off, and it's dangling from your pant leg. And I was not a very large 7 year old, but yeah, I remember that. So yeah, we both like furry people.
Yeah, I know. I think the best costume my mother ever made for me, like she did. Maid Marian from Disney's Robin Hood. She did Cinderella. She did... the heck else did she do? She did a lot for me. Like, she... and like I said, she handmade them. I had fittings. I mean, like a professional dressmaker. But the one year I wanted to be princess from G-Force, which is why I'm kind of sad Abe is not here, my parents worked in theater. And so she needed to make the beak and the helmet for princess from G-Force and with the white go-go boots and all that. So she made me like the dress, and I borrowed her go-go boots, which in the early 70s, you know, she still had them. They were way too big for me, but they covered my whole legs like princess.
Yeah, like the Nancy Sinatra boots, basically.
Totally. Yeah, yeah, but they were way too big for me. I mean, I'm an adult now, and I'm kind of heavy. I'm considered overweight, but my legs are still tiny. Like, I have tiny legs. I have, like, size 2 legs, which is, like, why I can't wear skinny jeans, because all the skinny jeans are just still too big. but my waist is huge. But anyway, so I borrowed her go-go boots. She made the dress for me. And then for the helmet, she got a motorcycle helmet. She spray painted it white, and she took professional theater gels because they worked in theater on Broadway. So they just like took a Bastard Amber, and that's the name of the color, Bastard Amber, that you would put. It's a standard lighting thing. Listeners can look it up. And she took the gel and she melted it. Because those gels were really highly resistant to high heat. Because back then they had, you know, blazing Fresnel lights and the stuff was very hot. And she actually took, like, a blowtorch and melted it to make, like, the beak out of it. And it's one of the things that I feel bad about today is that I didn't appreciate how much work went into that costume. That was awesome. Like, that she spent all those hours doing that to bend it the right way. And then when I went to that particular Halloween parade, I got laughed at because nobody knew who I was. And I'll never forget that. But what an awesome costume. And the sad thing is there's no pictures of it anywhere. We don't have any pictures.
Oh, that sucks.
Well, back then, you know, your parents didn't have money for film. You know, they didn't. It was like if you got one picture on Halloween, that was awesome, you know, and they did the best they could. But, you know, my parents didn't have a whole lot of money. And quite frankly, they like she probably spent all this money on the blowtorch and her art supplies to make it. If there was a photo, it's gone now. There probably was, but it's gone now. And I'm really sad about that because that I regret that every year on Halloween. I think about that costume and how much work she put into that. So, but yeah, after all that, I wanted a plastic costume like you guys had. So, you know, grass is greener.
I did Damien Karras, Father Damien Karras once too, which was easy because it was basically I had a Ghostbusters t-shirt that was black and then I just flipped it inside out. And so you have your black shirt. And then I basically, my mother made a felt collar for the, you know, for the priest collar. And I wore some sort of robe type thing like Karras did when he did the mass. And then I just said I was Father Damien Karras. And that was it. Simple.
Yeah. But anyway, getting back to our original point, I hope listeners will next year definitely post pictures in response to that post because it's always great to see what everybody does. And as far as I'm concerned, if you don't dress up on Halloween, why are you not? Like, it's an excuse. Do it. It's part of being a kid again.
Absolutely. A couple other news items. Call of Cthulhu, the video game, has been released. It's getting pretty decent reviews, at least by IGN, 8.5 out of 10. I haven't checked other reviews. It's on all platforms. I have not played it, but it takes place in Boston. You're a private eye or something like that in the 1920s. You're, a drugged-out booze-hound type guy, and basically, you know, the messed-up person in a Lovecraft tale, and you have your mystery. I know Kyle Radar, who's a member of our Facebook group, he actually said he's played about 2 hours. He says it's a slow burn, but he's digging it. And that just came out. That's all the news I think I have. Any other news for anybody? Anyone?
Well, right now, I think everybody's just playing Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yeah, I know Gage Foltz, another member of our Facebook group, he's actually beginning to play that, I think, as well. Have you started that, Mike?
No, I'm way behind on my games.
Right.
But it's set the record for the biggest opening weekend of anything ever. Right? Because it sold something like $700 million of games in the first week.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, my niece got that game, and she's done nothing but talk about it, so it must be great.
I'm still playing Far Cry 5 now. I'm still playing that the 48th time, so.
Right, so this is definitely an open-world game, sort of like Skyrim or Fallout.
Far Cry, I think it's
more mission-based, but...
Well, they have missions here and there, similar to, like, Grand Theft Auto, but you don't have to do the missions if you don't want to, type of thing. Kind of, you do, but you don't.
It's not as... It's like, from my understanding, I've never played Grand Theft Auto, but Far Cry is not as open world quite the same way as Skyrim and Fallout tend to be. And my understanding is this goes even further, and it's not, and it's much more player.
Far Cry 5 and 3 and 4 are kind of similar, I felt, to Fallout.
You don't have the large number of non-player characters, the kind of go anywhere, do whatever you want kind of thing. It's always basically go here or there and on this mission or that mission and kill people, or ignore those and follow your particular character quest to kill more people. But you didn't have like all sorts of stuff like where you're like setting up a home base in the same way and...
Right, you don't have the home base setups, that's true.
And just not nearly the depth and detail that goes into the world. It's not a bad thing. You don't have that in a Mario game either. It's just not what the game is trying to do. It's just not the same style of game. Far Cry is much more action-oriented game.
Well, that's true, but you have your outposts you have to liberate, and you have
by running in and shooting up and killing people, and then you never have to worry about the outpost again for the most part. I mean, I haven't played Far Cry 5, but yeah, I mean, it's basically a matter of doing missions instead of levels, but
there's no levels. Right?
And it is more story based. It's not just Doom, right? But
Right. Yeah, it's not linear. That's true.
Right. So anyhow, I don't know. It said huge. Now again, the thing to remember is that they probably spent 5 years and hundreds of millions of dollars developing it, and you get other games like say Call of Duty. They have $500 million openings like every year. You know, so while this is getting rave reviews, I wouldn't expect it to completely change how people do their gaming development, because it's literally the first game they've come out with in several years, whereas other studios are making three quarters of that on an annual basis by putting half the effort into it.
Right, that's true. I don't know if that would change anything, to be honest, because these other games are still making huge monies, even if Red Redemption, whatever, 2 made the most ever type of thing.
But what I'm curious about is the first game was very successful, but they came out with a sequel / expansion pack near the end of that game's life cycle, which was the zombie pack, and that ended up doing really, really well, and partly because that was hitting at the time that Zombie Mania was near its peak.
So is this new Red Redemption is not the zombie one? It's just a follow, another Western in, or something.
Right. It's basically Grand Theft Auto in the Old West.
Gotcha. Huh, how about that? Interesting. Yeah, I never played the first or the zombie one, even though I know they were very popular. Any other news, Mike or anybody, Chrissy or anyone? All right.
Nope. We should go on to the movie.
All right. So let's do that. So, Chrissy, what is our topic for tonight?
Oh, Phil, you would ask me that. Tonight, we are discussing the Korean horror found footage film, Gojan Haunted Asylum. And forgive me if I did not pronounce that right. It is based on a real place. The premise is, I'm not going to do wiki like Eric, but the premise is folks running a horror internet podcast are after a million views on their live investigation of one of CNN's seven freakiest places ever.
So basically, if we pronounce it phonetically, I guess it would be Gonjiam, because it's G-O-N-J-I-A-M, Haunted Asylum, 2018 film. It was released in Korea at the beginning of the year, March, and it's the second highest grossing horror film ever. Second highest grossing Korean horror film ever. After A Tale of Two Sisters. I thought it was Busan, but it's actually A Tale of Two Sisters was the highest grossing horror film, Korean horror film ever. But this is the second. It was a big box office success in Korea and actually outperformed Ready Player One, which came out at the same time. It has excellent reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, as well as most generally wherever you look for reviews for this film. Most people have said it's pretty good. A fellow podcaster, Don Anelli, basically the showrunner for the Horror Mafia podcast, he actually says this is one of his top five favorite horror films of 2018. It is nominated for the 55th Grand Bell Awards, which is like a South Korean Academy Awards type of thing, and it won Best Editing, and then it has nominations for the 39th Blue Dragon Film Awards, which is another like their Golden Globes type of thing, and that is impending, meaning it has not been announced yet. It was a budget of $2.28 million and has grossed $20 million worldwide. Directed by a guy named Bum-Shik Jung, written by him as well as Sang-Min Park. And then the cast is pretty much all Korean folks, but no one that we've seen in any of the Korean films that are fairly popular in the States. And basically the writers and the director are fairly new to people in the States as well. Warner Brothers picked up the distribution for the U.S. We can discuss how we heard about it and what we thought about it. It is actually on disc and rental everywhere. The disc and rental, it's released by Well Go USA, which pretty much does a lot of the Korean horror films, like The Wailing and whatnot. They usually release it to home in the United States. Let's go about how we heard about this film and what we thought about it. So I guess I'll start. Basically, the only reason I know about this film was I was in Walmart, and I always check the Blu-rays and DVDs, electronic section, whatever, CDs and so forth. And when I go to Walmart, every so often I'll pick up one or two or three DVDs or Blu-rays that I see there, because they are pretty good with releases. They have a lot of obscure horror films and indie films, believe it or not, at Walmart, as well as the Hollywood main releases. when I'm there, I look up the titles on the internet, because Walmart does give us free internet if you have a cell phone. You can Wi-Fi right to them. And Rotten Tomatoes actually gave this a pretty good review, as I stated, so I decided to pick it up. It was Blu-ray. It was under $15, new release, so I picked it up basically the day it came out, which was end of, or I should say mid-October. So I decided to watch it pretty quickly, 3 or 4 days later, and found footage. The place does actually exist, though they filmed the outside at the location, but inside, actually, they used an abandoned school in Busan to film it. I was pretty much overwhelmed. I was very happy with the film. It was a really good, scary horror film, well-done found footage film. The acting was solid. The scares were solid. Whether the scares pay off or not, these type of films are scary in the sense that there's a lot of jump scares. So I believe it or not, I actually covered my eyes over 10 times, maybe 20 times, just because I didn't want to have a jump scare spook. But oddly, there wasn't that many jump scares. They set it up as if there was going to be, but there's a handful, but not as many as I thought. And some of the most creepiest things were things that you discover, or they discover, the people that are starring the film, the characters, what they discover as they go along, like writing on the wall and it changes and things like that. So we'll get into all that stuff. So this is a really effective horror film, never mind a ghost movie or found footage horror film. Just for scares, I felt it was pretty solid. I don't know if it would be scary like I guess, you know, the first time you saw The Exorcist or anything, but I could see this is a huge date film in career, you know, 20 somethings going to see it and really being spooked out. So I give this a high recommend, big thumbs up, and it could be a top 10, most certainly a top 20 horror film for me by the end of the year. Mike?
I had seen ads, or it's didn't pop up on like the VOD lists. I hadn't read any reviews or knew anything about it, and we needed a movie to do this week, and you suggested this one, and it was this or something else that I don't even remember what the something
else was.
Yeah,
it was Mandy and Apostle and Gungeum Haunted Asylum, we voted, and this one actually won out.
It's so right. Funny, because I was going to say the same thing, Mike. I didn't remember the other two. I was like, so anyway.
Yeah, I thought Mandy was one of them, and I can't remember the other that Eric had suggested doing. I'm sure the fact that it was a 3-2 vote and two people didn't make it to this week's podcast is a complete coincidence. But no, Eric is just working late tonight, just to be clear.
Yeah, he's really stuck at work.
Yeah, so... So I watched it. I actually had to break it up over two nights, just because I got involved in other stuff. But it was okay, because it basically was the first night watching the first about 20 minutes before they get to the asylum, and then all the asylum stuff was last night after all the trick-or-treaters went home. So it was a perfectly natural break for the film. And it's a very found footage film. All the tropes that you're used to in found footage films are more or less there, including a lot of shots up nostrils. But I think it's pretty well done. It has some moments. There is a particular shot I'm fully expecting to end up on as a GIF at some point on Facebook, and we'll talk about that. And it didn't scare me, but it had some tingly moments. It may get more mileage out of other viewers. Oh, certainly, I guess it got more mileage out of Phil. But I still kind of enjoyed watching the characters going around the haunted asylum. I kind of laughed that the filmmakers didn't actually shoot in the haunted asylum themselves. Although I don't know if that's because they were scared or because it was a permit issue or something. But yeah, I would recommend it. Again, if you were a found footage person, I would definitely recommend it. if you're not a found footage person, I don't know that it's going to win you over.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, who knows if this building even, like, you can't even go in because of water damage, mold, floors could fall out under you. So who knows why they didn't actually record at the asylum itself. But it's probably, like you said, permits and or the building is probably condemned. Who knows? All right. Very good. Chrissy.
Well, I think most of you guys, well, you guys know, I will watch any found footage, even if when I'm going into it, I kind of know that it's crap, because it's a form that I feel a really close connection to. I'm a big fan of the unreliable narrator. I love what this subgenre does with that. For me, it leaves a lot of room for mystery. And if it's done well, it can be intriguing. That said, I feel that lately, you know, there hasn't been a lot of high quality found footage in the last few years. And I think that this is mostly because after seeing this, it kind of reaffirmed this for me. Found footage, I think, by filmmakers is looked at as, oh, we can do this really low budget. So people who are making it may be less apt to truly invest in things like good writing and good storytelling in terms of structure. And I did not find that with this film. I was absolutely blown away by this. I haven't seen found footage this tightly written and this solid since Exists. I told Phil earlier, which came out in 2014, which I also felt was excellent. But I would actually give this, I would actually say this is better than Exists. There was a lot done with tropes here, like Mike referenced, and there were many allusions to all sorts of films from cultures outside of the Korean culture. They did a lot with allusions and tropes in Japan's Ringu, for example. They did a lot with The Changeling. They did a few things with The Blair Witch Project. There's probably a few more that I'll reference later. But they were all of these tropes were put together in a way that was really creatively done. And the tension in this, which is interesting, you know, most found footage you get, we're going into this scary place and here's some jump scares because we're going to be in this scary place. But in all honesty, they really did a good job with the tension coming from the interpersonal interactions. And if you think about it, the setup itself, I also thought that this had a level of depth, like a message, but it didn't beat you over the head. It was sort of a social commentary on the internet itself, or the craze about the internet, you know, making money and we can be this and that and the other thing. You know, you have all these internet celebrities and they're legends in their own minds. And this kind of makes a comment on that in the very nature of the story, that things are not always what they seem. I did read a couple of reviews after the fact, after I saw the film, that said that the ending was kind of a crap out, that they needed to wrap this up or wrap that up. I kind of disagree with that. I think that it was very organically done. But like I said, I have watched just about every single found footage film out there. I mean, even the ones that were total garbage, I have watched every single one.
The Gallows.
And yeah, I mean, I watched The Gallows and I was horrified. I've seen The Jungle, which was pretty bad. I mean, I could give you guys a list of things I have sat through with found footage because any one I will watch. And this is just superior. It's really good. As Phil referenced, you might not be into this if you don't like found footage. But Phil, I'm going to go on a limb and say if I had to recommend a film to someone that hated found footage and did not want to give it a try, this one and Exists would be the two that I would say you got to try this one before you say, I won't watch it again. This one was honestly really good for me. I found very little fault in it. I really did. I think it's pretty damn good. So that's me.
All right. Very good. I do have the wiki. Chrissy said one or two sentences earlier, but I'll go with the back jacket of the Blu-ray. And this is what it says. Based on the local legends and stories of people who visited the real-life abandoned hospital, Gungeum Haunted Asylum follows the crew of a horror web show who plan to stream live from inside the asylum. To attract more viewers, the show's host arranges some scares for the team, but as they move further into the nightmarish old building, they begin to encounter much more than expected. So that's the wiki. And there's a blurb, a wonderfully contemporary twist in some old school horror elements by some place called Heaven of Horror.
Yeah, the story is basically Halloween Resurrection, you know, where they do the internet TV show in Michael Myers' house, and they set up fake scares to scare the people who are in Michael Myers' house. And lo and behold, Michael Myers is really there. You know, so this is a very familiar setup. You should be able to see the quote unquote twist coming a mile away. That ooh, there's fake scares, but wait, there really are ghosts. It's not the originality of the setup; it's the way it's all executed, though, I think is what really sells it. You know, and the actors and the characters, I think, really work well.
Well, I would agree with that, Mike, because, you know, once we find out that it's kind of being set up, we should probably throw out the spoiler warning now. But once we sort of figure out it's being set up, then it sort of comes in with that beautiful, unreliable narrator where you don't know what's real and what's bullshit. And that's what this film really excels at. It does that very well in a very subtle way. I mean, I was still trying to figure out halfway through what's real, what isn't. And it really kept me guessing. And that's why I think it's good, because I really think it used the advantage of found footage to its fullest degree.
Now, we've seen this type of story in like Grave Encounters and Grave Encounters 2, which were a couple of films that were a couple of years ago that got some acclaim and were liked by a lot of folks. This is kind of like those two films. You know, the Ghost Hunters TV shows that we all know that are on Sci-Fi Network and various other networks. Obviously, this is kind of playing with that, except this is more of an amateur crew doing it rather than quote-unquote professionals. As Mike mentioned, a lot of these Ghost Hunter shows on TV, I'm saying it too, but Mike mentions, you know, a lot of it can be fake or whatever. A lot of those Ghost Hunter shows aren't necessarily fake. I mean, they're real shows, but and I guess reality TV in a sense, but we never really see the extreme weird stuff that you would see that were faked in this film. But we do see these shows. I've watched them a couple of times, and you know, they hear a noise or there's something in the background that wasn't there, but they claim that it was there, and then they like make hyperbole over it, like, oh my god, what was that? Oh my god. And it's supposed to, you know, stress you out as a viewer to believe something's up. And of course the payoff is never pays off, because we're never going to see that ghost that, you know, they I guess are trying to promote. And always do see is like them talking about, oh well, there was a cold air here and there may have been something on the meter that moved or whatever, but again, there's really never a payoff. So this being a horror film, we figure that this type of hyperbole that the show runners or the people that are, you know, being filmed are saying will probably turn out to be true, or at least partly true, once the film gets to the climax, because again, that's the point of a horror film. I mean, sometimes we've seen other found footage films, like that Australian film Lake Mungo, where a lot of it we find out, or almost 90% of it was faked by the brother, but there's still 10% that is unexplained in that film. And that film is more of a quiet documentary type film rather than a found footage film. So there's many ways to do it. And this one, you could say, as Mike said, yeah, we probably have seen it before. But the question is, do they do it exceedingly well or not? And I think they probably do.
Well, I think, too, one of the things that sold this for me, well, as you know, my husband, you know, is a ghost hunter, was a paranormal investigator. He hasn't done it in a few years now, but he had his own TV show on A&E, which was, you know, a reality TV show. And he gave me a lot of inside information about how a lot of that is done. And, you know, now it's like 9, 10, 12 years later, a lot of things that went on Ghost Hunters were, you know, manipulated, and a lot of things that went on Paranormal State were manipulated. I mean, those things were manipulated. What I loved about this particular found footage aspect of it was that they used the whole greed and manipulation aspect of this and kind of brought it out into the light. I don't really think that I've seen that done as effectively as I've seen it here before in the whole ghost hunting type of found footage story. It's done in disaster movies a lot. Like Dante's Peak is one example, you know, where the characters manipulate each other in life and death situations in order to get more cash or to achieve an ultimate goal. And in this film, I really felt we got to kind of see behind the scenes of what goes on. Like that whole thing where they're like, you give us another 20% and we'll go in that room. That stuff really went on. And I'm going back 10 years ago, 11 years ago, when the ghost hunting craze was really hot. The ghost hunting shows really hit their peak between like late 2006 and like early 2008. So there was like a year and a half where it was in like its burgeoning. It was just exploding. And a lot of that stuff went on behind the scenes. And I love the fact that this film addressed that and showed it, which I have not seen in things like what you mentioned, Grave Encounters, Phil. Grave Encounters is considered a classic. I've watched Grave Encounters several times, but having kind of been on the other side of this, Grave Encounters doesn't, I mean, it's still kind of a like a schlock show, if that makes any sense. Compared to this, I felt like this really addressed some issues that do go on behind the scenes, especially with these internet shows now. You know, people just want to be famous. They'll do whatever. And I just really appreciated that they used that and they played it to its hilt. And that is something I have not seen in a ghost hunting found footage film before, ever. It was the first one that I've seen that's done it, and I've seen a lot of them.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Well, a couple of things here to just set it up. Basically, there's this asylum, as we said. It's on CNN's top 7 scariest places in the world to visit. That's real. There's this guy named Hajun. And like a lot of these found footage films, to make them, quote unquote, feel like they're real, all the actors in this film, their first names they use as well, so the character is named after the first name of the actual actor. There's only one character that uses a different name, and that's a character called Charlotte, because even though the actress is Ji-Won Moon, Charlotte is supposed to be a Korean American who's visiting Korea, and so she obviously would have an English first name or let me rephrase that, a Western first name for the fact, because Charlotte's actually, you could argue, is French. But the point is that they has a Western first name because they grew up and were born in America. And so she is called Charlotte. But everybody else, the actors have they use their actual first names. So Hajun, it runs this YouTube channel. Basically, if... if you get a million views, you actually get $1 million, I guess, because what happens is somehow this YouTube, whether it's YouTube or some form of YouTube, they get advertisements to the point where if you get a certain amount of views or hits, you actually will get money. So this guy really wants to promote it, and I don't know how he knows how to market it, but he does. And how he what he does is he gets six people, college students, or in one case a tourist, or a woman that's you know visiting family in Korea for a couple of months during the summer, Charlotte, and they all volunteer to do the show, and they're going to get a portion or a percentage of the money if they can reach a million. And that's pretty much the setup. And none of them believe that it's probably haunted in real life, even though they have old videos of other people going into the place and people have disappeared and whatever. And there's rumors of something dangerous behind one of the doors, room 402 or 412 or something like that. And people who've gone have actually disappeared. And so that's the myth that makes it even more spooky, I guess.
Well, the seven of the freakiest places on the planet that they mention that is on CNN, I did go and look that up. And one of the things that lended a real credence to me for this film is that that was a real article. I had seen it before. It was published on Halloween of 2012. And the first picture that they show in the movie is, you know, seven of the freakiest places on the
Chernobyl,
planet. And I'm
right?
like, and it was Chernobyl. And there are other ones on the list. So that was kind of based in reality. They do say that Charlotte, the character you mentioned, Phil, has been to like three out of the seven.
She's been
to those are real too.
The yep. island of
the dolls in Mexico. Yep.
And then the one in the Czech Republic, she said.
The Czech Republic, that's Sedlec Ossuary. I'm just going to go through this really fast.
Yep.
But the Sedlec Ossuary is a small, I'm just reading this out of the article. It's a small Roman Catholic chapel in Sedlec in the Czech Republic. It contains the skeletal remains of about 40,000 human beings, and they are dispersed throughout the interior in artistically arranged designs. So that was number two, which the character Charlotte visited. Number three is the Akigahara Forest in Mount Fuji, Japan, which, you know, was the suicide forest, and we've covered that on shows before. Number four is the – oh, boy, I'm going to butcher this. Akadawesa Fetish Market, which is in Lome in Togo. I believe Toge is in Indonesia, if I'm wrong.
How do you spell – is it T-O-G-O?
T-O-G-O. It's in Lomé.
That's actually Togo is a country in Africa.
Okay, so thank you, Phil, for correcting me because I had no idea. But a fetish market, just to clarify this, is not sexual. We in the United States think of fetish as sexual. It's not. A fetish market is actually a voodoo shop. You know, you can buy monkey bones and
Trilogy of Terror.
Kind of like that.
A fetish voodoo doll.
A fetish voodoo doll, but kind of more stuff like it goes a little beyond that, Phil. It's a little less specific than like the doll in Trilogy of Terror. It's more like it's where you go to buy things like crocodile heads, chimpanzee hands, like things you would use in voodoo spells. Chicken feet.
That is the weirdest game of password ever.
Yeah.
$20,000 period. That was it, yes.
Right. Well, and the thing is, you know, my husband did study voodoo with a lot of priests in New Orleans. Hi, Mike. I can see you on video. It's so good to see you.
I'm turning the video off.
Yeah, well, it's on again. But anyway, you know, my husband has a large closet of things like this, and they are bought in a fetish market. I had never heard of it before until I married him, and so that's how I know what that is. The Island of the Dolls is number 5. We already mentioned that. Battleship Island in Nagasaki, Japan is number 6. Battleship Island was... Oh, my goodness. It was like a city for a mining colony, and eventually it was abandoned. And number 7 is the subject of our film tonight. So I just thought I would share that with our listeners. So that was very much based in fact. But I will say that another thing I was very impressed with this film is that they really paid attention to the urban legends and really developed them in a way that was interesting. They bent them to fit their story, but not too much. It was kind of nice, which a lot of found footage films, when they're doing this type of thing, go over the top. This didn't do that. This was pretty spot on. Yes, they invented the whole thing about, you know, the ping pong table. I couldn't find any evidence of that. But they really did a lot of work, and they did a great job. So anyway, I just wanted to share that.
Yep. Very good. Yeah. So this is one of them. And basically they play up the CNN article a lot. During this live show, I guess, on YouTube or whatever. So Ha-Joon is definitely someone that knows how to market. So it's basically three guys and three girls, and then Ha-Joon is the seventh member, and he's the guy that's running it. He does like intros and things between cutouts, or when I say cutouts, I mean, you know, they'll film for a bit and then they'll stop to pause. And he's the guy that would fill in details or whatever. And that's all he does. And he basically is going to set up base camp. And then the other folks, the other six, are the ones that will actually go into the asylum. Even though it's three girls and four guys generally. The movie oddly does not have much, sexual tension at all. So it's really all the people are just there for business, which was kind of interesting because they're young people and they like drinking and they like partying and they like swimming and all that. So you figure it would be a little more college-y or high school-ishy party environment, but oddly, they removed this from the film completely. I thought it was interesting.
And well, I was fine with that because one is just a drop-in, right? So she's going to be there for a day and disappear.
Explain.
Charlotte, right? She's been traveling.
Yeah. She's from the U.S., right? So she'll be gone.
You know, and then. Yeah. And if
she's really good looking, so I thought all the guys would be all over her, but they are pretty professional.
Right, and then the other is just, you know, one, I think she's a regular on the show, but you get the sense that they're all kind of regulars on that show or have done the show before.
Right.
So it's just probably, you know, bunch of friends goofing off, and I don't think you needed that. I don't think you needed that extra interpersonal dynamic of having a relationship between, you know, certain characters, because there's really not time for it. There's no place to take it. So yeah, I think it just works fine without having that in there. And it was nice to see that they avoided a very easy cliche.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I felt it was odd because I'm so used to seeing that in films, never mind seeing it in this age group of people. But you're right. It really isn't necessary for the hour and 30 minutes this film is, or hour and 20 minutes that this film is. So yeah, it doesn't matter that it was removed. It was just something of note. But everything you said, Mike, pretty much probably sums up the reason why. And like you said, a lot of the folks kind of already knew each other anyway. It was only Charlotte, and that was it.
Well, not necessarily, though, because as far as them knowing each other, we get to know the characters, and it's done very quickly. But the motive for their being there is also very simple and believable. Horror Times live internet broadcast is what they're doing, and they refer to applicants in those first couple of minutes. So you know that obviously they've had some kind of contest. But I kind of love how they don't really tell you anything about it. It just all becomes clear later when we find out that some of them are a hoax and that, you know, some of them are working on this to hoax the others, which totally explains why they did kind of this contest thing. But I did appreciate the fact, like you guys did, that they left out the whole extra romantic thing because you don't need it. And I think that's what makes this movie so awesome. Is because, okay, whenever you have an ensemble cast, and I know I've said this before, it's really important that the characters are not all the same. And this goes for writing. It also goes for films. We need to be able to attach a quick brushstroke or an identifying characteristic to each character pretty quickly. And I think they did that very well in this film so that we could tell all of the characters apart. Which worked for me. Like, I knew who everybody was separately just from looking at them. And that was because they had done that very quickly in that initial dinner scene. You know, we have the girl with the cap, so you knew who she was. We had Charlotte, who spoke English sometimes and explained herself, so we knew who she was.
And
she was beautiful, too, so you knew. And she always had makeup on, and then they kept saying to her, why are you wearing heels? So it was easy to tell these characters apart very, very quickly. And did we get a lot of depth with these characters? No, we did not. But that is part of what found footage is. However, I think that this particular film did it very well with just giving us a quick brushstroke so we knew who everyone was so that when they weren't all running around and they were like, well, who the hell is that? Because, you know, it's and that, honestly, that's what Blair Witch did well. I mean, they had four characters and you knew who these people were right up front. You could tell. And Exist did that very well, too, actually. You knew. You could tell them apart. You weren't like, okay, who the hell is this? This is a red shirt. I never got that sense in this movie. I kind of knew who these people were.
Yeah, absolutely. Nobody completely disposable. If I were to guess at the beginning of the film, I think Charlotte probably had the biggest marker on her as sort of being the outsider of the group. That I would have thought would be the most likely to not make it the rest of the night.
Mm-hmm.
Because usually if you have an outsider coming into the group, usually they would be a point of view character for the audience.
Right.
But she was never that, right? She was never the way for us to get in to know these characters. And she was never served as that. So I kind of expected, but yeah, not, but it wasn't like, you're just very obvious final girl and eight red shirts. You know?
Also, a thing, Mike, that I thought was pretty good too is that they didn't have that little voiceover or card at the beginning that says, this is a true story. Unfortunately, none of the people were found, but we did find their footage. So since we didn't have any of that, that was another thing that is, all right, you have these seven characters. Are they going to make it or not? How many will make it or not? And we never know at the beginning because there's nothing that says that, like at Blair Witch or Exist or whatever, that says basically these people are all dead and this is their found footage.
And I wonder if they're allowed to because I think they don't. They I've watched a couple of movies over the weekend, so I might be getting things mixed up. But don't they start out by basically telling you that none of these are based on real events or real people?
Yeah, this didn't say that.
I thought it started with a disclaimer. I could be wrong. I was just wondering if that had something to do with maybe it's a Korean thing that they're not allowed to. Like in the United States, you can pretend that it's based on real events when it's actually not.
Oh, right. Yeah, I think you're right. This may have done. Yeah, you're right. I thought you were talking about something else. Yeah, so they had that blurb at the beginning that, yeah, this is. In other words, the thing that you find at the end of films. like or any film, which is usually have a couple. You have one is No Animals Were Hurt During the Filming of This. The other one is All Places and People in the Film Are Not Based on Anybody That's Real or Anything That's Real. And they actually had that right at the beginning, is what you're saying, right, Mike?
Right. And I'm wondering if that's just a case of something in Korea is they're not going to allow you to mislead people the way that, you know, most people at this point who are over the age of 12 should know
right.
that things like Blair Witch and The Fourth Kind are bullshit stories, that they're not real.
And Fargo, for that matter.
And Fargo.
Yeah.
Are not, you know, we're not real.
Texas Chainsaw, actually.
Right. But, you know, maybe they're a little bit more strict, but nevertheless, we do that and it adds to the, sort of adds in a weird way, adds to the atmosphere, even when you go in knowing that it's bullshit. Right. And maybe they just don't let the, let them do that in a Korean film.
Right. And actually it works because they do that at the beginning. We now know they don't have to, you know, pull a fast one on us. So again, we have no idea. We're just following the whole story as if we're watching it through their point of view or whatever. As if we're one of the camera crew that are just walking around with them. So we don't know if Charlotte is throwaway or any of them are throwaway, and so forth. So what did you think, Chrissy, about that? Did you feel, I mean, you mentioned you didn't feel they were throwaway, but what's your opinion of knowing that we don't know if there's going to be a survivor or not at the end? They don't have a flashback or a thing that says this was found and no one survived or whatever.
Well, that was one of the things I found particularly refreshing, that I had no idea who was going to live or who was going to die, if at all. I didn't know. I honestly went into this looking at all of these characters going, I have no idea. And I thought it was interesting that they kept throwing that, you know, we should send her home. We should send her home. You know, that one girl, they said we should send her home. She was the one that I thought they were going to get rid of first. And I don't think they did.
Yeah, she was She was the college student that had signed up.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah. Like I said, this movie takes the tropes and recognizes the tropes and uses them, but doesn't like abuse them, if that makes any sense. Like, they kind of do interesting things with it. I was sure she was the one who was going to kind of disappear first, but I don't know. Am I wrong about that? No, I think she was one of the ones who at least made it, because when they did their disposals of characters, they were always kind of at the same time.
Right. Right. Yeah. That
yeah.
Was the
you
same.
Didn't really yeah. get one right. disappearing. And then there was that one guy who disappeared later, but he was still alive. Like, so you really didn't, they did a nice job with that. I appreciated it. I really didn't go into it. I didn't look at the cast of characters in the beginning and said, oh, that's a red shirt, that's a red shirt, that's a red shirt. I honestly had no idea. I did know, I did suspect one thing, and that was when the captain came in, which kind of makes me laugh because we've been talking a lot about Captain Ahab lately, like last week with Halloween 2018 and Jamie Lee Curtis, and we're like, Captain Ahab. Well, I found it funny that they called him the captain, because he clearly was a Captain Ahab type of character. He was after his 1 million views, and he was going to do whatever he had to do to get that. So he was a Captain Ahab character. But other than that, the other people were just sort of, you know, they were all on equal footing. At least for me, I didn't spot any red shirt right away. But like I said, when the captain, I suspected something was going on when in that first scene, they all meet each other at the cafe or whatever. And the captain says, and this is the guy who's in charge of graphics. And I don't remember what he said, special effects or something. And I went, oh, there might be some bullshit going on here. Somebody might be faking stuff, but I waited to see. And then that eventually is what happened. But the second he said that, that was the only thing I kind of wanted, was I wished, my only criticism is I wish they hadn't been so obvious about that. I understand that you need to justify the twist, but that was a little bit too obvious. But do you guys understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think the thing that was interesting about this film is that Even though we are the as if one of the camera people walking around with these folks, Hajun, which is the captain or the guy that's running the show, we actually are on the perched on the shoulder of all the characters in a sense. So we get the perspective of the people who don't know that it's real. Don't know that they're faking it. And then we're sitting on the shoulder of the people who are part of the quote unquote conspiracy to fake it. So they get real reactions out of the people who don't know that it's fake. So as a result, you could say, as you said, Chrissy, that could be a minor unfortunate thing if you were hoping to be surprised throughout. But it's also interesting, too, because or a good thing, because we're getting the perspective of every character as the story and events are coming through. So we're getting the perspective of the people who think it's real, but then we get the perspective after that. Oh, we just tricked them. Great. That was an awesome face shot. It's going to look good on, you know, we just got another 10,000 viewers or whatever. So I thought that was an interesting aspect, too.
Well, this really exploits where we are now with video technology, with everybody having multiple GoPros and they've got a drone camera. And I'm trying to remember the last true found footage film we did. So we did Unfriended, but that's not exactly found footage.
I want to say it was Exists, Mike.
Well, there was Blair Witch was the other, what I was going to go with.
But that was kind of a blend.
Yeah,
but that was sort of a blend.
The remake one was a blend. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't remember it being a blend.
That broke the fourth wall. So for me, that's a blend.
But it was still a found footage film, right? It was all coming through the video that that the characters had, but that also used a drone, and I didn't find that they used that very well at all. It actually led to one of the more idiotic moments in the film. Here they have the drone. They don't really use it for much.
It's more to get cool camera angles to try to make it more of a professional. In other words, they're trying to make a film or a TV show that is as good as what you would see on regular TV. And nowadays, because we have drones, you can actually do the same shots that 10 years ago people had to use cranes to do. And I think that's the point of the drone here, is that they're trying to use it as a tool to do cool shots that would have been needed to do use cranes just 10 years prior. So it's more of a tool for the show, and it's never actually really used for the movie or the horror aspect. And I think that's what you're trying to say, right, Mike?
But if they're in a position where it's very, very plausible for them to have like multiple camera setups, everyone has their own camera, everyone's got their hands free, and you can put cheap cameras in the corner of every room if you wanted to do that. It's just a matter of, you compare this to where you were with Blair Witch when it was people with VHS cameras walking around, right? And video cassettes, you know, that they had to lug around everywhere. It just opens up the found footage format a lot more. And it's weird. And it's just odd because the format, I don't say it's dying, but it's certainly far less prevalent than it has been, at least over the course of the podcast. You know, it probably peaked about 4 years ago.
Right.
Something like that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I would agree.
So... And there's still a lot of good stuff out there, but I think people just got tired of it, and right now everything is the possession films, right? You know, it's...
Sure, yeah. The Conjuring, because of The Conjuring.
Conjuring and Insidious, stuff like that.
Well, I would like to comment on that, since we are talking about possession. I thought that when they were all... You know, they had this Blair Witch moment in there, which was kind of nice, when they were lost in the woods walking in circles. But then when Ji-Yoon, forgive me for butchering the name, is possessed, oh my God, wow. Like, I have never seen it done like that. That reveal was very unique. It was scary because it was simple. And then she thinks she's arrived in the 10, and Ji-Yoon is facing the back wall, which is a direct allusion to Blair Witch. And then there's another person who's gutted and facing her. I just thought that whole section in there was really brilliantly done. And with the whole possession, I thought the possession was done very well. It wasn't cheesy. It was creepy. It was quick. I mean, it was really disturbing. Like the whole, all of a sudden the girl's eyes glow black and then she's like, I was like, oh my God, that is crazy. But it was so clean. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of.
Well, see, the possession is the one that I said is where I can see that becoming an internet gif at some point on Facebook. And for me, that didn't work for me. That just felt silly to me with her right up in the camera. And mostly it was her face right in the camera doing that kind of thing. The noise she was making didn't work well for me, but that was me. It didn't work for me. But there was other stuff they did. Like the guy who has when the woman backs up into him.
Oh yeah,
at the end of the film.
Yeah, the very end. Yeah, right.
Or where they see the girl standing in the corner, and then like.
Oh, see the girl standing in the corner. I liked, but the woman where they backed into, I didn't like that.
Okay.
That I thought.
Well,
was cheesy.
You know what?
I was like, that's cheese. Okay.
Well, the reason they went there, even whether it's cheesy or if it was awesome, depending on your perspective, Mike or Chrissy. The reason they go there is because the myth behind the asylum is this woman that used to run the asylum back in the 60s before it was closed. And a rumor is that she was a evil prick and she tortured and murdered a lot of the inmates. And then she was about to get caught or be arrested or whatever. And so she suicides and is hanging. And so that's the hanging woman that appears at the end. And I could see how some would think it was awesome. And some, I could see your point too, Chrissy, where you thought maybe it was, I don't know, too right on the nose. Maybe. I don't know. What's your issue with that?
Well, it's not really an issue. I think one of the things this movie does well is that, like I said, Mike liked that part, but I didn't. And I liked a part and Mike didn't. I think that this movie actually offers something for every horror fan, pretty much. Like,
yeah, yeah.
If I could interject,
for me, like, you know, you guys like certain things. The things I liked the best were the quiet moments, like when they noticed that the words were reversed on the wall.
Yeah, that was. Yep.
Or the doll moved, but no one had been in that room, you know, and things like that. So the quiet things were the things that like creeped me out. But anyway, continue your. So in other words, my point is that we all like things we're creeped out by things, different things. And like you said, the movie has a lot for all different type of horror fans. But continue.
Well, that's what I mean. I think it's going to appeal to whatever you like. There's going in found footage within that context. There's going to be a lot. I mean, my favorite parts of this film, honestly, were the things where there were doors slamming, but she didn't see anything. The sound is what really got to me in this. Whereas the sound, like where she was going, blah, 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 you know, that sound upset me. That bothered me. It wasn't so much her face in the screen. That was fine. That didn't scare me. But the sound really bothered me. So I think there's stuff in this movie for everyone. And what's also interesting is, for me, the way they played with the urban legends associated with this place was interesting because, you know, I had known about this place. I knew about it. I've done research on it in the past because of working on various novels, because everybody knows I love abandoned places. I'm always looking to write new books or new short stories that happen in abandoned places. And this has been on my list for a very long time. I haven't created anything about this place yet, but someday it'll come. But the reality is, this place, as far as there's a lot of urban legends that have grown up around it, but the reason that it really closed was because there were issues with the sewers. So it's a very unromantic reason that it closed, which is why I think it's cool that at the end they were doing all that stuff with water, like water on the ceiling and water on the floor. I was like, oh, they're kind of playing with this whole sewer idea, which was real. And of course, most asylums the world over closed because the economy didn't support them anymore, or it was no longer, you know, I mean, supposedly people, supposedly there was somewhere, God, I can't even remember because I was going to look it up today and I just didn't get the time. There were a number of deaths at this asylum. They happened within the span of 2 or 3 years. I want to say it was like 50 deaths or 30 deaths or something. And it happened within like a span of a couple of years. That is where all these urban legends got started. The reality is, I don't think there's any proof of that. It's internet rumor. But we do know that the sewers were an issue. That was a problem. So, sorry.
All right. So, I'm just thinking the Haunted Sewer Asylum is probably a very different kind of movie.
Indeed. On a side note, or back to this specific film here, So basically, the thing that was curious for me that made me think that something fishy was going to go on, meaning that some of it was going to be faked, was how a handful of the people went in before the whole crew go in and set up the GoPro cameras and the motion detectors and all that. Because if they're already in the place and they're worried that it's a haunted place, when everybody else goes in and those cameras are already there, it's like some of the suspense is already gone, in my opinion, at least for behind the scenes. Because, again, we're watching this from behind the scenes. We're not necessarily watching it from the straight perspective of what people would be on YouTube. We're watching it both ways. And when they go in first and set up all that stuff, it's like, okay, nothing happened to them then. So if anything happens to them later, it's going to be faked. And so some of them, when they do happen, the things that do happen, like the fake seance and or whatever, burning of the incense or whatever they did, it didn't surprise me when I find out that, okay, there were some people that were behind the scenes actually working with the quote-unquote captain to fake the whole thing so we could get more viewers and people to be interested and reactions from those who weren't in on the scam.
Oh, see, that's so funny, because where I got the first clue that there was going to be faking was that other thing that I mentioned where he said, this is our special effects guy or whatever he said. But when they all went in ahead of time, I didn't even react to that. I didn't even blink. But that's because, like I said, my husband was a paranormal investigator for a lot of years, and I know that he used to go in ahead of time and set up things. And that didn't necessarily mean he was faking anything. It's just sometimes when you do an investigation, you go in during the day and set up the cameras for the evening. So it's just funny that I didn't even bat an eyelash at that. I was like, oh, okay. But yeah, you're totally right, because then when they got to the scene with the bells, that was like really interesting. I found that one really interesting.
Yeah, Mike, what about your opinion of that?
The whole bell thing, it wasn't going to surprise me that someone had gone in. I guess there weren't any, that's going to be, not to be a play on words, there weren't any warning bells until they actually got to the bells, to me. It wouldn't have surprised me if they had set up something, but it also wouldn't have surprised me if they hadn't. But then when you got to the whole thing with the bells, it felt really contrived. Right, to have this whole thing with all the bell, you know, just this the string of the bells, it felt fake.
Right.
And then certainly you have them doing the ritual and everything drops down, and it didn't. Yeah, then I was kind of pretty sure that was there. Yeah. So stuff like you mentioned the moving of the doll or the changing of the words. One of the problems with the changing of the words is that it's in Korean.
Right. Well, I had to actually rewind it, and sure enough, it is one of the Korean characters or words is the same, which basically it says we want I forget what the hell it says, but basically the word death is one of the words, and that
right.
word is there in both the when I, you know, looked earlier when I rewinded it and looked after, and it's reversed when I looked after versus the original. So you're right, since it's different language or characters. You're right. It's a pain in the ass, and that's why I have to go back into it.
Well, what the problem is that they tell you the words change. They tell you the doll moved. And I'm sure on an internet show they would do that. And because it's a Korean, I would have no freaking clue if she didn't say the words changed. Whereas if this was an English language film or if it was, let's say, a picture, it might have worked more for me if I had noticed and been allowed to notice those things kind of on my own.
Right.
As opposed to Charlotte saying, "Oh, look, it moved. Scary." You know?
Right. Or saying, "This doesn't say what it said, you know, 20 minutes ago."
Right. You know, that's, that's the equivalent of show versus tell. And they were telling us something scary happened. And they sort of showed it to us, but I saw the doll. I hadn't picked up that the doll was actually in a different spot because I just visually didn't.
Oh, I did pick up on that. But my thing is, if, you know, here's my question with the translation in this, right? And they're giving us the subtitles. What I kind of wondered was, did they put the subtitling in with that particular plot point for American audiences? Because Koreans would have seen it. So did they actually add that in for American audiences or for people in other languages? Because I found this translation to actually be pretty solid, except there were a few places where I was like, nobody said anything and you just flashed something across the screen to see me read it so I could read it.
Right.
But nobody said anything. So I was wondering if maybe in Korean, in the Korean language, that plot point isn't in there. But since none of us speak Korean, how would we know? Like, that was kind of my question. But
Which plot point exactly are you talking about?
The one Mike was talking about, where he said they're telling us and not showing us.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Which I agree with, but I had to wonder because I was like, but it was in Korean right there underneath. Like, if we spoke Korean, wouldn't we notice? Because they actually highlighted it. So did they actually add that? Because there were some spots in the film where people were not speaking. I noticed this, but they had the English subtitles underneath. And I'm like, okay, but nobody said anything.
Right. That's weird.
So
I
don't know if you guys
that.
Noticed that. Yeah, there was a couple
I did
of
not,
places
I didn't
where I was like, wait, nobody said anything. What the hell? Like, nobody said anything. Why are they not there?
Oh, actually,
so I wonder.
I could answer that. Actually, whenever there was words on the walls or on the doors that were important to the plot, there would be subtitles.
Oh, yeah. That's pretty standard.
You understand that, Chrissy? So, in other words, when if there's writing on the wall and it's not important to the plot, you know, like graffiti, they won't put subtitles to let you know that that's what's written on the wall. But if it's important to the plot and there's writing on the wall or a door or on a piece of paper or a newspaper, then they'll put subtitles for you to know what is written there. And that's what you're probably seeing.
Oh, okay, maybe. Maybe. But then my question is, why did they go ahead and tell it? Like, a Korean audience would have known that. Unless they were doing the same thing that we do in America, which is like, oh, our audience is dumb. We need to,
explain
stuff.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I was expecting. Because it's one thing, like, you would expect someone to say, oh, look, and then you look, and then you say, look, it changed. Oh, it used to say this, and now it says this.
Also,
you know, the way they handle it.
Also, you got to understand this being South Korea, and even though South Korea, especially, is a fairly large country, you know, it has like 60, 80 million or whatever it is. Their films, just like from a smaller country like, say, Norway or Denmark or the Netherlands, they try to push those films to the widest audience they can. And even the captain says that, oh, okay, we got people from the Philippines and from the U.S. and from France and whatever watching the show too. So they're trying to subtitle it anyway. In other words, having Charlotte there too helps too, because she can speak English. So in other words, they're not just trying to present this show to South Korean people to watch. They're trying to have this as an international show. So language is important only as a tool to communicate between themselves, and it's really the subtitling to the world that's the most important, because not everybody's going to be speaking Korean, because it's not a international language of business or communication as, say, English is, for example. What's that, Mike?
Yeah, they know. I'm sure the filmmakers know, especially horror filmmakers know, that if you want to make money, you need to break out of your country, and the biggest market for that is probably English language market right now.
Right. Well, like that movie that we did, like End of the Line, right?
Right.
That's the name of it. That was done by a French-Canadian director whose first language is French, who has a thick French accent. And when I talked to him, he said he specifically made the whole film in English and got people that spoke English and did it in English intentionally because of what you just said.
Right. I just watched a French horror film over the weekend called The Night Eats the World, and it's a zombie apocalypse film,
but
it's mostly a one-character zombie apocalypse film, so there's almost no dialogue through large chunks of the film. So they filmed every scene with dialogue twice, once in English and once in French, well aware that their biggest audience is going to be the English language audience.
What was that zombie Norwegian Nazi film?
Dead Snow.
Dead Snow 2, the second one,
right,
was intentionally done that way as well, because there's an English language version and a Norwegian language version, and they're both considered the same. They're both considered original. In other words, it wasn't one that was just dubbed over for English language. It was actually filmed in English, but it was also actually filmed in Norwegian too.
Right.
If you go to that Blu-ray disc, you can watch it in either format. The Norwegian version is a special feature, and that's when we did that episode. I actually watched that one while you guys all watched the English language one, so it was kind of interesting. This here, back to this film here. So a lot of the language and subtitling and all that are intentional for us to view, meaning because, you know, we're Americans watching a Korean film, but it's also because this is supposed to be a fake show for the world to view. They're going to have all that stuff in place anyway, just for the fact that that's how the show is released. What else? What did you guys think of the history behind Asylum? I guess that is, I don't know if that's true or not. Chrissy, I know you read the seven places by CNN and all that. Did you actually read to see why this place is considered scary, and if what they said as the backstory to the film about the woman suiciding that used to run the asylum, and if any of that's true?
Well, here's what's interesting, and it's what I was referencing earlier. A lot of urban legends grow up around these haunted asylums. And, you know, living in New England, and Mike living in New York, and even Eric, I know Eric lives near a haunted asylum. There's a lot of urban legends that grow up around this crap. I did not have the opportunity to do as much research as I wanted to for tonight, but I have done research in the past on this particular place. Like I said, the real reason that this place closed down had to do with the economy, had to do with sewage issues, and it wasn't a haunted sewage problem. What happened was the conditions apparently were so unsanitary that they could not be fixed. And according to records, the original private owner of the place just took off and left it to just steep. And apparently it got so bad that it was unhealthy and it just basically shut down. There was also the economic downturn. So the real reason is that it is not as romantic and scary as they say. However, there is evidence that there were several inmates who did apparently commit suicide, like in the year before it closed. And so that is probably what gave rise to the idea that, oh, there were all these murders and blah, blah. But mostly I think they did with this film an excellent job of taking the real history and kind of morphing it into something that was terrifying and very believable. I found, for example, the thing about the ping pong ball to be very organic. It really felt organic to me, even though I knew it was bullshit. I've done my research. There is no talk about ping pong balls or anything, or even that the director was a female. The owner of this place was actually a male. But I think they did a very good job. And this is why I said earlier, I think they did well with their tropes in this. They took tropes and they kind of blended them kind of with the real thing. And the interesting thing about urban legends and about ghost stories is that there's always a grain of truth. There is always one tiny grain of truth that somebody can grab onto and go, oh, this could make a great story if I just add a bunch of crap to it. And I think the problem with a lot of films is that they try to make it too over the top. Like if you talk about, you know, a lot of remakes and stuff, like the Amityville Horror, for example. If you look at the original Amityville Horror, or you know the real story, you know, based on documentaries, or you knew George Lutz, like my husband did, or whatever, and you kind of know what really went on. And then you get to like the 2005 or whatever year that was, Amityville Horror. That movie is like, I mean, that's like over the top. They just took everything and just threw it at it. And I think what they did well with this movie was they took pieces of truth and they really made it into something that sounded believable. It was really not too over the top. Room 402 might have been a little over the top, but again, that's a trope. You know, in every haunted building, there's a room you're not supposed to go in. I also loved what they did with the showers. Did you see after the guy got the shower or whatever, and then after they're all dead or whatever, the shower just turns out by itself? I really love that. So I would say for this film, they took the urban legends that have been circulating and they did a really good job beefing them up, but not so much that they're ridiculous. So I hope that answers your question.
Now, explain.
Did I answer right?
Explain the ping pong thing, because that was a curiosity. First off, they used to have ping pong tables for the inmates, and the woman that ran the asylum supposedly liked playing it as well. But you're going to say something, Mike?
Yeah, well, they were saying that they would hear people would hear ping pong balls when they were outside room 402.
Right.
Yeah, right. And what happened in 402 again? I forget what it was.
Well, see, we don't really know, but here's where that's one of the instances where I thought this movie also excelled, because like I said earlier, they borrowed things from tropes in other cultures. Okay, like and illusions, right? They borrowed like the dark-haired girl from the Japanese concept of, well, Ringu. I mean, there's a whole other thing about that, which I'm not going to go into because I'll be talking about it for an hour. But they borrowed the whole dark-haired girl thing, which is very, very steeply rooted in Japanese history that goes way back to the feudal age in Japan. So that's been around for like hundreds, if not thousands of years. They borrowed from, you know, but they also borrowed from films. Like they borrowed from The Changeling. You know, they have the rolling wheelchair. They borrowed from The Shining. They borrowed from, I mean, there are so many films in other cultures that they borrowed from. And the ping pong ball thing was interesting because they, you know, in every psychiatric hospital, right, they always have rec rooms. And if you look at a lot of urban legends surrounding, like we did, okay, we did Session 9, right? And Session 9 was about this abandoned asylum. There were rec rooms in that. You know, they go into the cafeteria or whatever. So there's places that are peaceful. I mean, even here, I've got 15 minutes from me, I've got Fairfield Hills down the road. There's a whole rec building there with gym equipment that there's all these urban legends around. So I think they kind of borrowed from other cultures in terms of not only tropes, but also like specific films. And they just kind of stole those things. But I think they did a good job blending it together. Did I answer the question or did I answer your question? I'm not even sure I answered the question.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But the ping pong ball was made up. I'm just saying real because, a place like that would have ping pong balls and stuff.
And that's an interesting point that you made, which is, you know, it's recreation or whatever. And they turn something that's supposed to be peaceful, as you mentioned, and recreational into an omen of bad things to come. Because anytime you hear the ping pong ball, there's going to be some bad things that's going to happen.
Well, and even the idea of a ball at all, that's borrowed right out of The Changeling. The Changeling was the first American film to do that in 1979, the whole ball bouncing down the stairs. It's been stolen ever since. It was in The Woman in Black. It was in, I mean, it's been in so many ghost stories. The whole idea of just a ball, whether it's a child's ball or a ping pong ball or whatever. So they borrowed from that too. So, and that's why I think this film is brilliant, because I think they really knew what they were doing. Whoever wrote this movie had a really great lexicon in his or her own brain of, this is everything that goes on in ghost stories in America. This is everything that goes on in ghost films in China. I mean, there was stuff borrowed from China. There was stuff borrowed from Japan. The very fact that they picked the room number as 402 and the fourth floor, okay? In the Shinto religion in Japan, 4 is death. Now, in Korea, I don't think they have Shinto there, but they do have Buddhism and Taoism.
Yeah, they're
and
mostly
that also. I mean, there's all kinds of crap going on in this movie. It's really pretty amazing. I'm sorry. I'll be quiet.
No, I was just going to say there's a large Catholic folk or group in Korea. In other words, a lot of Koreans are Catholics is what I'm saying. But you're right. They have a lot of other stuff that predates when Catholicism became popular in the country as well.
Right. And like I said, the number 4 as the worst floor. If Korea doesn't have Shinto, which honestly I don't think they do, and
they don't.
But that's borrowed from Japan, because 4 is the number of death. In Japan, you do not do anything in 4s. Here in America, 4 is balanced. You know, it's
state
or whatever. But in Japan, dude, you don't do that. You give somebody 4 flowers.
That's like my favorite number, too. 4 is awesome.
Yeah, but it's their big thing. And so I just found it interesting. And I just wish I'd had more time, which is why I bought the Blu-ray today, because I really want to watch this movie a few times and see what the hell else they did, because I'm sure I missed a lot of stuff. I'm sure there's references to all kinds of other stuff in here, and I just missed it because I only watched it once.
Now, let's move on to the captain. What did you guys think of him? At first, I liked him, but then when he became a megalomaniac, in the million was more important, views was more important than the mental health or the physical health of the 6 people inside the asylum. That's when I was like, okay, he's just that was kind of a trope when you find out that the leader becomes the villain, like a lot of films. Also, I actually thought too that he was insane when he decided to go into the asylum himself, because the moment he saw that the words were reversed, I mean, that one, there's no way you can change. So I couldn't believe that was one. The main issue I had with him was when he said, I'm going in to finish this thing. And I was like, at this point, I don't think anybody would go in if something like that happened. What did you guys think about him and his attitude and how he reacted and all that?
You know, he seems like it's his personality. It seems like a personality type, right? The I've got to be the guy in charge. I've got to run things. He doesn't have a problem playing this elaborate prank on people for money, right? So I don't know that I had too big an issue here. And here he is. He's about to make a fortune, and these fucking people are blowing it. That is the way he's looking at it. You know, he doesn't believe what he's seeing is actually, you know, a ghost story.
But, Mike, the moment he sees that the writing on the wall has changed, there's no way you could change that, right? So you would think he would think there's something fishy going on.
I think people's ability to rationalize stuff is pretty remarkable. And he's, you know, and so he doesn't know what's going on. I don't think he's ready to accept that it's ghosts. I think if there's anything about these characters that is that's going to make them unlikable, it's just the fact that that most of them, at least the guys in the film, are really insincere about what they're doing. Right? They're not going out and filming haunted asylums because they believe they're haunted asylums.
Right.
And now we have made no secret of the fact, Phil, that you and I are skeptics. And I will not view things the way that Chrissy does and her husband Nathan do, but I will never for a moment say that either Chrissy or Nathan is being disingenuous about their belief in the supernatural. All right, I think they clearly do believe it. I just disagree with them. These are guys who clearly don't believe in it because they're going there, they're setting stuff up to scare the shit out of people. And they're presenting themselves as people who do believe in it, which you could argue that's entertainment, right? But they're not being honest to the people that they're, you know, to their audience that they're there, that they're the ones setting it up. They're misleading people into thinking that they're really in a haunted asylum. So, yeah, there's a little bit of dickishness that goes with that, especially I'm thinking with the guy who's running everything.
Well, and he does become, like I said earlier, like a Captain Ahab. Like, even in the beginning, when they all have that dinner, they're all like, yay, 1 million views, all this money. We're going to, you know, their focus is on the money. And he just becomes obsessed with the money. And even when, like, the stove catches on fire, which, by the way, I thought was super cool and a really kind of unique way of saying, hey, the spirits are really here. And then all the lights go out in his tent. He's still swearing, going like, oh, my God, how could you do this to me? Like, he never believes in the supernatural, even as the tension gets ratcheted and he's seeing things he can't explain, because he really is like Captain Ahab. He just wants these 1 million views. He wants to make all this money. And that's why there's such a beautiful irony at the end of the film, which I thought was really neat, because that kind of parallels what the girls go through when they leave. But I guess we haven't gotten to that point yet. So, but anyway. So, I did not have a problem with him, if you're asking, Phil, of him running into the building. I didn't at that point. And there were a couple of reviews I read that said that felt ridiculous or that didn't feel genuine. To me, that did feel genuine because he was obsessed. He was crazy, you know. And once people get to that point where, you know, the whole movie, you're seeing those views go up, right? They're always showing 600,000, 300,000, 800,000. He was getting the drug. He was getting the drug of being famous. And so that, and making his money. And so that kind of like a megalomaniac, like you said he was feeding off that. And so his final thing is, well, the hell with this. If these guys aren't going to do this, I'm going to go do it myself. And that made total sense to me. Because he really was, at that point, obsessed with just money. And like Mike said, they were never in this because they believed it. They were in it because they wanted to make money. And that's a whole different ballgame, you know?
And I've got no problem with people who are in things to make money. But there's a way to do it that's honest, and there's a way to do it that's dishonest, right? And you could try to do it as somebody who debunks these things. You could go into it as a skeptic. Right, but they go in pretending they're believers, and they're just full of shit.
Yeah, that's a good point, Mike, because because you could argue that he is amoral, because if he went in to try to debunk or went in to try to prove it, that's one thing, but to trick people, that's just, P.T. Barnum. without being great like P.T. Barnum. He's just a hack.
Right, but I agree with you, because I think he was a hack because he was really all about his own megalomania. Whereas, I mean, we could have a whole other discussion about P.T. Barnum, but I don't necessarily believe that P.T. Barnum was, yes, P.T. Barnum was in it to make money. Yes, he was in it to do things, but the sensibilities were different in the late 1800s.
He was really, and plus
he was really trying to entertain people.
That's what I was
saying. It's different. And he made money on the side, and maybe that turned him into a megalomaniac later, but that wasn't his original intent. Whereas this guy, you get the sense that, oh, it's all about money. And that's why I think the whole building fucking with them. Like, for example, the girls go outside and you have that whole Blair Witch thing where they're like, again, an allusion to an American film, Blair Witch, where they had tied the underwear on the tree earlier and they're like, oh my God, how is this possible? We're walking around in circles. We're totally lost. But then we realize that Charlotte is actually still in the building. They're actually still in the building. And that's why I think this metaphor, this film is a metaphor for everything is bullshit. Like, what you really believe in terms of what's on the internet is not really real. Like, I actually think this movie has a message.
Oh, what? What?
Yeah,
what?
I know. Try not to have an attack, Mike. But yeah, it's true. I really think this movie had a message.
Yeah, next thing you're going to do is all those friend requests I get from those beautiful women on Facebook that they're really not into me.
Damn.
I know, it sucks because I get all kinds of hot guys from Afghanistan saying they want to, you know, do things to me too. And I'm like, damn, this, you mean this isn't real?
Yeah. Right.
But I do think, for me specifically, it was a comment on these people who do all these YouTube things. And not to say that they're wrong, but there's a lot of people who are YouTube celebrities that are really just capitalizing on people who are alone or people who want to live vicariously or, you know, and we've talked about this on this show before where, you know, where we talk about internet trolls and we talk about these things where, you know, if people are kind of on the, you know what I mean? They're kind of like, they have the blessing of anonymity. So therefore, they can be whatever they want. They can pretend to be whatever they want. And I think this movie was metaphorically really a comment on that. That's just my thought. But
it makes sense. And most certainly, you could take it as that. Whether it was intended or not, it's most certainly a valid thing that can be taken out of this. If you watched us, that, you know, the whole, it's partly commentary on the internet and how a lot of it is phony. Absolutely. All right, so let's get into some of the scenes about, you know, them when they decide things are real and when we find out things aren't real, and you know, because so we can get to the end and explain what we felt about it. So Chrissy, you were the one that brought it up, talk about, you know, the girls deciding to quit and all this other stuff, and then the people that were inside that were part of the scam actually saying, actually, you know what, it's true, there's weird things going on here.
Yeah, I mean, I really liked that because I was totally buying the bullshit. I was like, oh my God, they really left and they're wandering around. And then they slam them back into the building itself. And then I thought that was really cool. Oh, and I think I forgot to say what I was saying earlier, the fact that they end up in room 1402 and then they can't get out because they're like, oh, later on, they're like, oh, we're in room 1402.
402.
That's a 402, sorry. That's a reference to 1408, Stephen King, right? Where the guy can't get out of the room and they hear him screaming from the other side, but there's nobody that can open it and it's locked up. Yeah. So again, but I think that was really interesting use of that trope too. But yeah, I just think that it was really well done. And I love when we see that she's running toward the tent and then it turns out not to be the tent and she's back in the room. I just thought that was really good. And I also thought that, you know, the naked guy that kind of had like the cut down the front of his body when she's in there and he's sliding his like foot across the floor, which was like a really awesome, scary, unsettling noise.
That was really effective for me.
Really effective. That really freaked me out. But it also, for me, was almost a reference to It Follows.
Ooh.
with kinda, a naked person just standing there in the dark, and you don't really know who it is, and it's from
and
I like that too.
They could have probably got it from there, like you said. They grabbed a lot of stuff from other films, right?
Well, that's really what I think they did. I think I would hazard a guess that whoever wrote this film just had a really was very well educated with what was going on in the tropes in all kinds of foreign films. And I am sure there are things that I missed from English films and French ghost films and things, you know, films I'm not widely exposed to. I'm sure they took things from other cultures besides just American and Japanese. But those were the things that I noticed because those are the most films that I watch in this genre. But yeah, I'm sure. I thought it was really great. And like you said, Mike, that thing where he was dragging his foot on the floor, that was awesome. Like, I just had all kinds of chills going up my spine. That was so amazing. I just thought, wow, that is really great. And I also liked the one part. The other thing that gave me chills was where the captain is sitting there, and he's like, oh, there's all six people there. Who's filming this?
Right. That was a good one.
Right?
Too.
Now, that's a trope. We have all seen that done before, but for some reason, the way that they did this, I was like, oh my God. Like, I was just like, wow, that is messed up. I just really, but I've seen it before. You know?
Right. Yeah,
whose
sure.
hand am I holding? You know, the haunting. That's exactly where that came from. But it was just really well done. So anyway, I don't know. I'll be quiet now. Mike, you haven't talked in a while.
Yeah, I just, again, it's like the, who's filming it? See, now again, that didn't work for me. It didn't not work for me. It wasn't like I said, oh, that's terrible. It just, and I moved along. So again, I just find it interesting that how different parts of the film are clicking with us in different ways. And again, that's part of it. They're not doing Insidious, where every scare was drop the piano. And it's basically if the dropping the piano worked for you, then you were going to love Insidious. And if it didn't, then it probably wasn't.
I liked another one too, which is in the shower room, and they look on the wall, and there's like a silhouette burnt into the wall that could or could not be a person, or it could just be aging of the wall. And they talk about it, and it's kind of creepy, and they never go back to it really, and it never is a ghost or anything, but it's enough to set up the mood and the atmosphere, like,
yes,
you know. And so, you know, I'm like, all right, I got to cover my eyes here because there's going to be something jumping out of the.
Well,
the
I thought that was particularly well done because none of them treated it like it was supernatural. And I kind of like that. They're all like, look at this creepy shadow. It looks like a person. Ha, ha, ha. And then they moved on.
Right.
And even later when you see it again, nobody assumes it's supernatural. Like, they're just like, oh, look at that creepy shadow. Ooh, it's creepy. Like, I kind of like that because that type of thing in an American film, they would have gone crazy with that. They would have had stuff coming out of there and like, ooh, I'm scared, you know, and they didn't do that with this.
They could just have done something like move the position of it at some point.
Yeah, but, and they didn't, and I appreciated that.
But the fact that they introduced it and that you mentioned it follows, right? It makes you start looking at the shadows. It makes you start looking, or at least made me. It made me start looking at, you know, because all of this is point source filmmaking, right? So you're from the camera and using the on-set lighting, right, from whatever natural light they have or light from their cameras, so you're getting a lot of shadows all over the place. So I was spending a lot of time watching the film, looking at the shadows, waiting to see if something was happening, and that was part of the reason why, is because they pointed out this silhouette on the wall, and even the silhouette on the wall was sort of like, oh, look, if you look at the toast and squint, you can see... You can see Jesus's face, you know, and so it had that element of hucksterism before you realize that they're hucksters. But you never knew, is it going to turn into something or not? And that's something that's really important, I think, for horror films, is sometimes to have something there as a red herring, to have something there that doesn't pay off or doesn't pay off when you expect it to pay off.
Right, and that's exactly, because why point it out unless you're going to pay off? But not by not paying it off, it's just an added creep factor and whatever. And to be honest, that could be something that just wasn't even in the script, and they saw it on the wall, and they go, oh, let's add that to the script. That's a cool idea.
Right, like something like I think of Poltergeist, and I remember seeing that in the theaters, and I was waiting for that dead canary to come back to life at some point in that film. Right, I was waiting for the little girl to wake up and the budgies sitting in her,
right,
in her bedroom or something. And they never do anything with it, you know. And then there's the clown, right? The clown doll, where they set it up. You're waiting for the clown doll to come to life and attack the kid, and then it turns out it's the tree. Spoiler warning, right?
Right.
But then they do pay that off later. But if you pay some things off and don't pay other things off, you never know what's going to be where, and the goal is to keep your audience off its footing. That's how you create nervous tension. And if you don't do that well, if everything is a scare when you expect the scare to be, that's not going to work. It's going to be too predictable.
Right. And you know what else I thought was cool too is that the girls, Charlotte and the other girl that decide to bail, their hysteria is. It flowed to me in a sense because and obviously it's a movie, so it's just not the same. But my point is that now once their hysteria goes, and then we see that the words have been flip flopped on the wall because that's something that you couldn't fake. I was like, okay, now I got to really be careful and start covering my eyes because I'm going to be freaked out. So in other words, their hysteria helped rather than. Like, in other words, I've seen a lot of movies where the hysteria of characters becomes annoying, but their hysteria actually builds the tension, and I thought that was awesome, too. Because a lot of horror films and people complain, like, oh, the women are just screaming and hysteria, blah, blah, blah. But here, it works, and it adds to the film, and the danger isn't anything that is like a serial killer that's coming after him. It's a possible supernatural presence that we're still not 100% sure even exists. And so by having them be hysterical and saying, why are we even here? Let's get the hell out of here. I don't know. It just helped me with the film, I think. But
yep.
Anyway. Anything else anybody want to bring up? Anything?
Not really. Should we talk about the end?
Yeah, let's do it. Go ahead. Oh, Mike, you want to say something?
No, go ahead. Go into the end.
I was going to comment that I thought that the very ending was really interesting, but I wanted to kind of ask you guys about it because, okay, it shows 502 viewers at the end after they were clearly almost up to 1 million, right? And then someone says, we see in the translation, it's not a live broadcast, and the other person types back, oh, it says it cuts off, and then somebody says, oh, I knew they'd fake the whole thing. So I wasn't sure at the end if this was actually all in their heads and there never was 1 million views.
Oh, interesting.
Do you see what I mean? I wasn't sure. Or had it just dropped at that point, like, and it was already done. I really wasn't sure. That's why I want to watch this again, because I think there was some really good shit in here I might have missed.
Mike, what were you going to add to that?
I missed that. My guess is that when everything goes down inside the asylum, right, they lose their footage, and then it stops being interesting, right? And
okay.
And the ghosts or what have you may have just completely cut the feed, you know, or in some way, shape, or form, or interfere with the broadcast, so they stop getting it, and so people just start tuning out. Because who's going to watch the guy just kind of run through the woods? You know, and right. They just said, oh, this is bullshit, this is, you know,
right,
nothing really going on here. But that would be my guess.
Okay. Yeah, because I saw the 502 at the end, and given the whole theme running through this about what's real and what's not, I was almost like, oh my God. Like, was this all in their heads to begin with? And it's that comment that, sadly, I didn't get a chance to write down. But it's the one that responds, you know, it's like I said, the first person says it's not a live broadcast with a question mark. And the other one says something like, No, it cuts off right after, and I didn't write that down. But I want to look at that again, because I'm almost wondering if it was, like, cut off really early in the broadcast. You know what I mean? It cuts off right after they go inside or something like that. Like, I thought it was really, I don't know. I just wondered if it had even made it out to a million views at all, or if it was in Captain Ahab's head, because, you know, he's the only one sitting there seeing the numbers go up and the numbers go up and the numbers go up. The others are not seeing it.
Well, that could be, like, if, and then, so that's, and again, I had missed that whole thing. So maybe, like, if they never got the feed from inside the asylum, it could have just been, like, the anticipatory build-up, right? Who's tuning in to watch this, and then nothing happens. And so the numbers drop down, right? Because everything happens, I think, in real time throughout the film, after you get to the asylum, or at least go inside. That's, at least I would think it does. Am I wrong about that? So you're probably talking like about an hour inside the asylum?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, well, actually, what I'm doing right now is I'm going to do something dumb here. I'm going to go back to my watch list. I'm going to see if I can go all the way to the end and just see if I can. There might be noise here. Okay, hold on. I'm just going to see if I can get to the end. Okay, here he's screaming. No, that's not what I want. Okay, this is what I want. Okay. And there were, like, subtitles where it said, and then there's these two chicks getting up from the chairs and leaving, which was kind of weird, too. Please come help me, blah, blah, blah. All right, hold on. I'm trying to find out here. Yeah, this. Oh, and you do see the faces looking out of the doors. I didn't even notice that.
Yep.
That's interesting. Right. Yeah, see, this is why I really need to get this Blu-ray and watch it again, because I think there's a ton of stuff that I missed, and we see the empty tent. It's not a live broadcast. It cuts off after it turns out a fake show. I knew they'd manipulate the whole thing. Okay, so there's at some point earlier, they figured out it was a fake show, and that's when people turned it off. So that's when I'd have to go back to the movie and watch it again and be like, okay, at what point did they kind of make it apparent to others that it was a fake show? Because that's when it cut off.
Right. Right. Yeah, so.
Yeah, so I don't know. That's why I wanted to ask you guys what you thought, because I'm like, wow, was this.
Right. Well, I think what happens is when the captain gets involved and comes out front and starts acting weird, the audience begins to say, start thinking that the whole thing's just a farce and a crap shoot, a crap, you know, crap show, rather than anything real. And you're right. I watched it about a week and a half ago, and
yeah.
I haven't rewatched it, so I forget exactly. But yeah, there's something that happens that if you were viewing it as a YouTube person, you would then know that it's fake. But it isn't fake as we see, because we're getting to watch it from behind the scenes.
Do they pick up anything that the captain says? Because there's things that he says that obviously betray that it's all bullshit.
Right.
Right. And there's also a moment where he says, I'm just going to do a replay. So was it after that moment?
Right. Right.
You know, I'm totally going to watch this again and see if I can figure this out. Like, because I think, I want to guess right now, based on my instinct, that the fact that the audience figured out it was maybe fake is probably earlier than we think.
Right.
Right now. It was the way, this isn't a live broadcast, and it was !
Right.
And it was only when they had 502 viewers at the end, right? But
right.
In the very beginning of the film, when they start, they only have like 300.
Right.
So I don't know. Like I'm saying, I'm going to get this movie and watch this again, because I think I can figure it out if I watch it closely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I think I remember that it was something that was obvious that would make people think it's fake. It's just that all three of us are forgetting, unfortunately, what that was. And Mike, you could be right. It could be something like when the captain says something that wasn't supposed to be aired. And then, like we're trying to fake it for the others or whatever. And then what you said, Chrissy, too, which is that it mistakenly is noted that it isn't a live broadcast. And it was replayed or something. So, yeah, so there's something. But you're right. That's another thing that could be somewhat of a commentary about the internet and social media or whatever, where, the whole thing is a farce and whatever. But the thing is we get to watch the whole movie from the aspect of both the YouTubers as well as each individual person that's part of the seven crew as well. And we get to watch it in a subset of that too. We get to watch it through Charlotte's and the others that don't know that they're being conned, as well as we get to watch it through the captain and the couple of guys that know that it's all a con, or at least the beginning anyway. Anything else anybody wanted to bring up?
So was he what? Did he see himself coming into the asylum?
Yeah, I was really confused about that too, Phil.
Because I couldn't see what he was seeing through the window.
Yes, he was seeing himself. It was like,
I couldn't say what. I was going to rephrase that. When he was coming to the asylum, you saw something in the window, and I couldn't make out what it was.
It was him. I think it was.
So that was him. But was it him looking at him? Was it him hanging?
It was him. It was a loop where he's looking out of the window later, and he sees himself, someone in the distance, and we find out that it's, there's the twist is the whole time he was looking at himself. So it was like a loop, a time loop type thing that he got stuck into.
Yeah. See, that was the thing that I wasn't sure about either. But that if that's true, that's also a callback to like
a lot of films,
1408, and a lot of other films. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But not that I'm criticizing this movie for that, because I'm not. I think they took all of these tropes and these illusions and did a really good job.
Well, because a friend of mine runs a local haunted house, and so we've had conversations. And really, haunted houses, like haunt attractions, not real haunted houses.
Right.
They're all about jumping out and saying boo in the end, right? And so just how well do you dress it up and how well do you set it up? There's only so many ways to scare people. And so when someone finds something new or newish that works, steal it and put it in something new. And all of them do this. I mean, that's how you get new subgenres.
Yeah, no, Dan O'Bannon in the Alien commentary tracks admitted that everything is copied. I mean, nothing's original.
Right. No one said, oh, shit, I was going to do a story about a guy in a mask killing people, but they already did Halloween. Damn. Right? No, they just saw, Halloween made a shitload of money, so let's throw 150 million more movies with men in masks chasing after people and going to kill them. Right? And some of them will be shit, and some of them won't be, but it's, the idea is you see other people take techniques of films like it, and It Follows, or Blair Witch. I mean, obviously even the found footage was something that worked and has been copied endlessly ever since then.
Right.
So, in
this movie, let's go to a haunted asylum, and guess what? Grave Encounters already did that,
And Session 9, right?
Session 9, you're absolutely right.
But that's fine, because...
The Haunting and Hill House.
Right, we all like the haunted house stories.
Dracula had the asylum.
A House on Haunted Hill, that. Yeah. Go with it, right? So it's not the originality that would ever bother me. It's always going to be the execution. And like I said, there's a lot of this that's very familiar. And in the very broad strokes, other than the fact it doesn't have Busta Rhymes doing kung fu fighting with Michael Myers, in very broad strokes, this is the story of Halloween Resurrection. It is a much better film than Halloween Resurrection. It just did the concept 100 times better. Except it doesn't have the kung fu fighting.
There you go. I haven't seen that movie, so I can't comment, but I'll take your word for it.
It's pretty bad. It's pretty bad.
That's what I hear. All right. Anything else anybody want to bring up? Anything? All right. I guess we can give our final thoughts. So I'll start since I started earlier. This is a solid found footage film. It's interesting because Mike, said his opinion, but I don't. And then Chrissy said this is one of her best favorite found footage films of all time too. So I don't know how to explain it, but I'll explain it simply as this: as a movie that scared me or was I thought was going to scare me, and I was worried about jump scares and all these other things that you would find in these type of films, this is very effective. Whether it actually scares you is a different thing, but I mean, I was covering my eyes or looking away or looking on the ground because I was just worried that they're going to have that jump scare, and it's like, okay, I don't need that. That's what a horror film is supposed to do, make you feel uncomfortable. And sure enough, this movie did that to me many times. Whether it's a great film or not, it can be a different thing. Whether it makes you uncomfortable or scared doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be also a great film or a good film. But I would say this is a really good film anyway. And I enjoyed it tremendously. It's worth watching. As Chrissy said, it's definitely worth watching another time because there's a lot of stuff that you could miss in this film, and when you rewatch it a second time, you'll say, oh, look at that, or this or that. I could see things probably in the background that we may miss prior, or scenes that, like, who's filming, and they mention it, but I bet you we probably could have caught that had we been looking for it earlier, and so forth. So it has a lot of good stuff. The atmosphere, obviously, good. Anytime you have a haunted asylum or asylum, period, that's abandoned, that's good anyway for a horror film. The characters, honestly, weren't annoying. I liked all the characters. They were fairly well rounded individuals, weren't annoying. They weren't tropes. None of them were tropes. We didn't really even talk about that, but they wasn't the geek, the virgin, the dork, the powerhouse, or whatever. I mean, they were just people that were in their 20s that, you know, I could relate to. So, high recommend, and Charlotte is hot. Chrissy.
I highly recommend this film. If you're into found footage, if you like a creepy little movie, if you like to be scared, I personally was not scared by this film, but that was because I was so busy looking at all the awesome things going on in it. I really didn't have time to be scared. I just think this is a wonderful, creepy, unsettling film that just knows what it's doing. And I love it. And I think that even if you don't like found footage, even if you hate Blair Witch, give this one a shot. Just try it. This one and Exists, definitely two of the best found footage films I've ever seen. I think this is definitely better than Blair Witch, actually. And Blair Witch has always been my top favorite. But yeah, definitely give this one a shot. Try it.
All right, Mike.
Yeah, it's a solid film. It's got, for some people, it's going to start out with two strikes because it's got subtitles and it's found footage. And I don't know that it's going to win you over if those are things that you can't deal with. But if that's not a problem for you, or more importantly, if that appeals to you, you know, if you like haunted house movies, if you like spooky haunted asylum films like Session 9, then I would strongly recommend you give this one a try. I should point out, like, we did not talk almost at all about the first 20 minutes of the movie, which is your typical found footage fare of getting everybody together. Right. And the gathering of the forces before we go to the spooky place. And that's pretty generic. But it's once you get to the asylum is when stuff really pays off. But that first 20 minutes is important in laying the groundwork and introducing us to the characters and so forth. That's really all I can say is it's a solid recommend, but it is a strong, solid film.
All right. Very good.
I would just like to add one more thing. For those of you who don't like films with subtitles, I found these subtitles to be very clean and clear and simple. It's not like you're going to be reading 17 paragraphs on a screen really quick, right, Mike? It's pretty,
I would say,
like,
that
in terms of subtitles, it's pretty low key.
Only the first 25 minutes, there was a couple of times that the subtitles flashed too quickly, and I had to stop and rewind to read it. But after that, once they get to the asylum, everything, the subtitles were on the screen long enough that I could read them before they went to the next subtitles.
Yeah, it's not too bad. I mean, I watch a lot of subtitled films, and I'd have to put this one right up there in the category that this was not too crazy. Like, I could do this. So if you're skittish about subtitles, I would say try this one. It's not too bad. It's not too overwhelming is really the word I want to say. Okay.
Yep, I would agree. That's Gonjiam Haunted Asylum, GonjiAM. All in all, solid found footage film. If you like found footage films, it's definitely worth checking out. You can find it anywhere for rent right now, so Prime and Vudu and iTunes and whatever. Also, you can get the disc for under $15, whether it's Blu-ray or you just prefer the DVD. So it's readily available everywhere, and it is getting good reviews besides from the three of us. So with all that stated, Mike, why don't you lead us out?
Well, thank you for once again listening to the Dark Discussions podcast. Please tune in next week when we will be talking about something else.
And stay out of abandoned buildings. That is the lesson for this week.
Yeah, asbestos is very dangerous.
Backed up sewers, very smelly.